So we're talking about evil this morning, and it's an old-fashioned word. There's no doubt about it. When we think of evil, what do we think of? Do we think of them? How about him? Or her? And we think of what it takes to overcome evil. Do we think of her? Or more seriously, when we talk about truly overcoming evil in our world, how about him? Or him? Or her? And knowing we are not Martin Luther King, Gandhi, or Harriet Tubman, where does that leave us? Now, we know that the Judeo-Christian tradition traces evil back to that serpent in the Garden of Eden. We saw that serpent this morning so beautifully played, and to the disobedience of Adam and Eve. Evil in both the Jewish and Christian traditions refers to those thoughts and deeds which are contradictory to the will of God. Islam sees evil as the result of humanity's ability to disobey Allah. Hinduism's concept of dharma divides the world into distinctions of good and evil, but primarily speaks to the bad actions of people rather than the fundamentally evil human being. Buddhism sees desire and delusion as the root of evil, and out of both desire and delusion, human beings act in ways that increase suffering. Now, historically, religious liberals have rejected supernatural conceptions of evil, of Satan, and instead sought to understand evil through multiple lenses, like psychology, anthropology, economics, and so on. And this is quite necessary to understanding the complexity of evil as it plays out in the social sphere, but I think it can ignore certain drivers in the human heart, forces that these old religious traditions perhaps more successfully explained, and that they saw them as emerging from within human desires rather than simply the result of external factors. In turn, early Unitarian and Universalist theology has been criticized as being too optimistic in this way. Universalists focused so much on the love of all humanity that some felt they ignored the human capacity to do great evil. Unitarians were so concerned about the social conditions that led to evils of injustice that some felt they missed the drive within the human heart toward selfishness and evil. Today, we would be most wise to see evil as the product of both internal and external factors. Now, I've gotten acquainted personally with that internal force in something I do in my spare time. This is one of those coming out services, right? Some of you know that one of my hobbies is acting in local theater productions. I enjoy the sense of community found in theater, and when I'm on stage, I practice being fully present, which means it's a chance for me to leave behind all the things that I would otherwise be thinking about. We all need some kind of spiritual practice, something that clears our minds and hearts so that we can be receptive to the new ideas and things that come our way. Now, I tried meditation, I tried nature walks, and a whole host of things, and finally recognized that acting was my primary spiritual practice. Sometimes we have to think outside the box when we're searching for what spiritually sustains us individually. I have a confession about these roles. Lately, I've been specializing in villains. Not just any villains either, the worst of the worst. There's me as Dracula, me as the title character in Oscar Wilde's The Picture of Dorian Gray, and there I am as Sherlock Holmes' nemesis in The Hound of the Baskervilles. Currently, I'm playing the very bad man who you may remember terrorizing Audrey Hepburn in Wait Until Dark. Nobody likes someone who picks on Audrey Hepburn, right? So I think one of the reasons I keep being offered these roles is because I'm willing to explore that dark place within myself. One of the things that happens with acting is that it helps you develop your empathy muscle. When you first sit down with a script, it is a puzzle. The playwright rarely tells you directly why the character does what they do. You have to figure it out. And when characters are overtly evil, most people's first reaction is to think they have nothing in common with them. But when we look below the surface, we often find that we understand those characters better than we thought. I found I shared Dracula's sense of isolation at various periods in my life. Well, I've never done what he did. I could see becoming drunk on my own sense of power over others after being kept separate for so long. Dorian Gray's obsession with maintaining his youth reminded me of my own issues about aging and mortality. Being Sherlock Holmes' nemesis reminded me that there are situations that puff up my intellectual vanity. I recognize that as far as these characters are from the person I believe myself to be, I can still see what we have in common. And rather than turning away from this, I believe we are wiser when we face this knowledge. Reverend Tony Larson says, "Anyone who claims he or she doesn't do wicked things is either trying to fool others or trying to fool themselves. It's the nature of the human to be evil as well as good. And you should not be a Unitarian Universalist if you're not willing to admit that about yourself. As a matter of fact, recognition of your evil has great power for mobilizing compassion. I say that from my experience in counseling. Some of the best therapists are the ones who know how to sin a little, maybe a lot. They're more tolerant of the human condition. They react with compassion rather than self-righteousness, with understanding instead of judgment." So February is Black History Month, and we've been talking kind of on and off about Coretta Scott King and Martin Luther King Jr. And I mentioned they'd attended Unitarian Universalist churches early on in their relationship. Now, Coretta said in an interview not too long ago that they seriously considered becoming Unitarian Universalists. Two things stopped them. One, they felt they wouldn't be able to reach the Black community if they were Unitarians rather than part of an historically Black church. And two, most importantly for our purposes today, they felt that liberal people of faith like Unitarian Universalists are much too blindly optimistic in their view of humanity, not taking seriously the reality of humankind's capacity for evil. And yet we currently live in a time when self-righteousness on all sides of the political spectrum has become de rigueur. Pronouncements of what or whom is evil are given with little room for nuance. I appreciate the urge to do that. I really do. It makes people feel good to do that. It makes people feel like they are on the side of good, and those people over there are on the side of bad, and most of us sleep better when we can separate people into groups like that. I don't really think this was what Coretta Scott King was talking about, though. Having a frank view of evil is not about having a glibly pessimistic view of humanity. Goodness knows, I doubt the Kings would have done what they did if they weren't acting out of a pragmatically optimistic framework. No, what I think she's saying is that people of liberal faith, in our attempts to, quote, love the hell out of this world, as the old Universalist adage goes, love the hell out of this world, we sometimes turn away from that human capacity for evil. I know in playing those villainous roles, I found within me that there's more potential for evil than I ever really acknowledged was there. I have no intention of tapping into it in real life. You can all breathe a sigh of relief, right? But I'm glad to have recognized the worst parts of myself, because it's good to know those places that are the most selfish, that are susceptible to flattery and vanity. Otherwise, our own capacity to do harm slips up on us. It creeps up on us. But let's step back, because what are we talking about when we talk about evil anyway? Harvard theologian Gordon Kaufman says, "It is that which destroys life or prevents the full unfolding of the full powers of human life. Evil is that which dehumanizes." And I would nuance this to say that evil is that which is destructive of human potential and yet avoidable. Avoidable is really important. Because if we take something like murder, we can see that, yes, of course, taking another person's life cuts off their potential, and murder is avoidable. Death as a result of a terminal illness where humanity has done all they could to help, and that isn't always the case, but if it is the case, that's not evil because it is not avoidable. even though it does cut off that human being's potential. If we think systematically, we get into territory that requires deeper discernment. What systems in our world today destroy human potential in ways that could be avoided? Consider racism, sexism, homophobia, all of which cut off opportunities for people to be the best they could otherwise be. All are avoidable, thus they are evil. So when we think about it in this way, we must look at ourselves too. Gone is the flamboyant evil of Dracula or the Wicked Witch of the West. Instead, there is the banal, everyday evil that we are perhaps part of. Do I participate in systems that cut off someone else's potential? Yeah. I'm sure that even while I try to be conscientious, I purchase items from stores and manufacturers that are causing people pain somewhere in the world. Moreover, my very existence in this world was built on certain evils, abuses of human beings that helped my ancestors stay employed and gave me the options I had to be educated and finally to be able to stand up before you today. My life has been built on much good, but there is evil there too. And I continue to be part of those systems today, even as I try to pull at the fabric of them and not participate where I can. I think it's vitally important right now that we take a clear-eyed look at evil in the world, even within ourselves, because otherwise we stop seeing its complexity. It's one thing to name it when we see it in a Hitler or a Stalin, but it's another to actually see the complexity of systems of evil that put a Hitler in place, the thousands or millions of ordinary people who engaged in everyday evil to put evil into power. And thus we must ask of ourselves to do something that is incredibly difficult, to see and call out evil as we notice it, even within ourselves, to not shirk from the depths evil may plumb, to not look away or excuse it, and yet at the same time to recognize evil as part of human existence and something we have participated in. If our life circumstances were different, we might be engaging in evil in more overt ways. This is a tall order for all of us, looking at evil in all these ways, condemning it even as we acknowledge that its potential lives within us, all of us. There is ongoing potential for wounding and sickness within the human spirit. We're all prone to it, and we would be wise to seek a way to keep from succumbing to it. This was never more clear to me this week than when some of us here from this congregation and dozens of people from the larger community stood outside the homes of our congressmen to demand our voices be heard on the issue of responsible, attainable health care. One of the speakers in our group was a woman who, with tears in her eyes, spoke of the anxiety her family is suffering because of their very real fears about the loss of their health care. "I don't understand why they would make some of these decisions," she said. "Where's the basic human love in their heart?" Now, this really struck me. If we're ever going to have the quote, "The creation of specific communities within the larger society that will manifest and foster deeper and deeper intensities of love," that Marjorie Hewitt Suchocki talks about in her book, The End of Evil, then individuals are going to have to be whole in their own hearts. Suchocki talks about a center of love which forms the core of communities. I'm convinced we don't have this communal love if the wounds of individual hearts and minds are ignored. So let's talk then for a moment about spiritual practice as a cure for spiritual wounding. Reverend Scott Alexander says spiritual practices are how you can spiritually examine, shape, and care for your life and the life around you to achieve more wholeness, satisfaction, depth, and meaning. These suggestions range from meditation and prayer to recycling and vegetarianism to quilting and art. I mentioned earlier that acting was mine. He goes on to say that spiritual practices are any activity or attitude in which you can regularly and intentionally engage and which significantly deepens the quality of your relationship with the miracle of life, both within and beyond you. So it's important to note, as Reverend Alexander says, that spiritual practices invite us into places of more wholeness, depth, and meaning. Spiritual practices open us up not just to the positive, but the whole spectrum of human experience. That includes good and evil. Knowing the places in ourselves where our vanity puffs up, where we go against our better instincts, or that little voice inside us that some might call conscience or others might call God, where we fall into the trap of ignoring that voice and giving in to desire and illusion, as the Buddhists talk about, and then we cause suffering to others and thus thwart human potential. In a talk about evil, Reverend Dr. Paul Raiser focused on racism when he said that we can recognize that the evil of racism poisons our spirits as much as our institutions. We must be willing to do the difficult soul work necessary for spiritual transformation. Having a spiritual practice is thus vital to not just our own individual health and well-being, but the health and well-being of others. In other words, a bunch of spiritually ill people will never make society well. And having a spiritual practice helps us to get real, to see the potential for evil within ourselves, to raise our children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren with the understanding that real evil doesn't come in the form of caped vampires and talking serpents, but within the everyday actions and choices of human beings. Engaging in a spiritual practice with intentionality and depth brings us more deeply in touch with who we are authentically, warts and all. And when we do this, we are able to respond to injustice from places of truly felt compassion. And finally, with all this talk of evil, I want to say something about good. It's here. It's here too, and it's here to stay. Love has always been on the other side of evil. I don't think it's going anywhere soon. It has great power. It can hold us through a long night. It can rock us to sleep at last, but it can also wake us up. Love can remind us what we need to do, what we are called to do for others in the world. Just as we must take evil seriously as a force to be contended with, one that we must struggle against or fall victim to, so too must we take love seriously. So too must we have hearts and minds made whole by regular spiritual practices that encourage us to cultivate love, like the love we find in this community, just as deeply and meaningfully as we discern the presence of evil. And so we go forward, recognizing that the fight against evil begins in our own hearts. It begins not as a warrior cry, but as a moment of silence, a whisper even. And from that whisper will rise up a chorus of voices, raised in songs that speak not of evil, but of love in its greatest, strongest capacity. Love that is built to withstand evil. Love that reflects back at us our own capacity for harm, even as it breaks that looking glass 1,000, 1,000,000 times over. Those fragments of mirror left glimmering in the light of yet another dawn.